agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm floating on air like a Chinese balloon.
Oh, very good. I like that one a lot. So, and we will be talking about Chinese spy balloons as well as a bunch of other things, including the Tyre Nichols killing, the Durham probe, and former Attorney General Barr's role in it, the removal of Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee, and a bunch more. And we're going to get at that in just 1 second. Okay, so we open with the killing of Tyre Nichols by five Memphis police officers after a traffic stop on January 7th. Early this week, police body cam footage of the incident was released to the public, and that happened the day after a grand jury indicted five officers on a number of charges, including second-degree murder, aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping, official misconduct, and official oppression. Like a lot of other people, you know, I watched the footage and I was, I guess, stunned and sickened would be the words that come to mind at that level of brutality that I saw and what seemed to me to be complete lawlessness on the part of those officers, as well as just the indifference of everyone to this guy's plight after he had been severely beaten by the police. And, you know, in the wake of this, President Biden spoke with the Nichols family. He told them that he would make a renewed push for Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And we talked about that when 2021, when it came out, and just some refresher here, it would provide states grants to set up independent procedures, processes to investigate police misconduct, excessive use of force. It would restrict the application of qualified immunity for police officers, and it would require that state and local forces that get federal funding have anti-discrimination and anti-bias, anti-racial profiling training. And this legislation passed the House in 2021, nearly unanimous support by Democrats, nearly unanimous opposition by Republicans, and then it went to the 50-50 Senate where it, of course, died. So, Jay, what's your take on what happened in Memphis and more broadly, what, you know, if anything, can or should be done at, I guess, the local, state or national level to make what happened to Tyre Nichols less likely, far less likely to happen in the future?
Yeah, I guess my response to the second question is I don't know, right? If I had that answer, I'd be, you know, hopefully somewhere in a better position to do something about it, or I'd be out there pushing that answer everywhere. In terms of how and why, I'm going to go back to it was not long after the Floyd killing, and I had sat down with a good friend of mine who is a police chief, now retired police chief, and you got his thoughts. And it came down for him. This is somebody who'd done this for 30 years, not beaten people to death, but been a police officer for 30 years. That it's just a matter of these officers lost their humanity. They forgot that this was a real person. And in his view, It wasn't a racial thing. It was a "we're the police, you're not" sort of thing. And to me, that is the biggest issue. I don't know how to solve it, but I think it's an issue you see anywhere where you're dealing with people who are just empowered by the state. And I think you know, it goes back to, you know, the Stanford prison study. Right. That was done back in the 60s where they did the experiment where certain students were chosen to be, you know, jailers. The other people were the prisoners. And And what the study showed, now, as parts of this have been disputed and perhaps debunked over the years, but the conclusion was, listen, these otherwise normal students, when they're put in this position of power over someone else, become sadistic, right? They abuse that power. And to me, that's one of those, you know, conservative gems, right? That you look at, human nature has no history, that people, if you give them too much power without some sort of checks, they're always going to abuse it, no matter how good they are, no matter how well trained they are. In that heat of the moment, they fall back on something else. So I don't know as far as the answers go. In terms of police reform, I think a lot of the stuff that was in the George Floyd Act, and a lot of it mirrored stuff that was in Tim Scott's Police Reform Act, or not act, but bill. I think those are good and positive reforms. That said, I don't know that any of those provisions would have made a difference here. And I'm in a bit of a loss, as I think you are too, right? I mean, when one of our earliest shows, we had talking about a police brutality case, and you and I came up with the brilliant solution that body cams, and you made the point, and I agreed that, well, geez, yeah, these body cams aren't terribly expensive. Everybody can get them. Everybody knows they're going to be watched. You know, let's get body cams for everybody, and that should solve the problem. But it obviously hasn't, right? All these officers knew they had body cams. They had the body cam on. Everyone knows they're being watched and filmed these days. But yet they still did it. So it's one of those.
I guess we've been talking about this for a while, for many years, as you said. I guess I'm at less of a loss to feel like I know things that would be helpful. I think when talking about the Floyd Act and the extent to which it would have prevented or could have potentially prevented the sort of things we saw in Memphis, I agree and I disagree. I agree that directly, no, it wouldn't have done anything about those officers on that in that incident. But the idea, I think, is that police should feel that they're going to be held accountable. Because if you ask the question, why is it that they can have body cams and yet still do that? Well, maybe partly it's because they don't feel like they're going to be called to account. Why is it that paramedics can come to the scene and for 19 minutes basically administer no care to a guy who's writhing on the ground in pain while the cops are off joking about, the stop they just made and beating the guy's ass? I mean, it's because in large part, I think that they feel like they're not going to be held accountable. And so things like having investigatory independent forces with some real teeth, things like restricting qualified immunity in a meaningful way, I think those are the sort of things that they might not do a lot for some of the cops who've been the bad apples, who are been on the street for a while. But I think it does set a tone going forward. And all of a sudden, if people who we give the authority to arrest, detain, to physically harm people, if they start to feel like, well, wait a second, there actually is a non-trivial chance that I will be called to account, that I am not above the law, then I think that's going to result in a change of behavior over time.
I don't disagree entirely. I look at, in this case, there were consequences, quick and immediate, right? They all were fired immediately. Five of them have been indicted for criminal penalties that could put them behind bars for, something like 20 years. That's some quick and harsh accountability, but it still happened. I'm not saying that, like I said, that the reforms in the Floyd Act aren't helpful or aren't good. I'm saying there's something more. I'm saying I think this is probably sort of a problem that you can't easily legislate yourself out of,
Right. And I agree to the extent.
Because it's a perennial human nature problem. And I don't know.
But I think you would agree with the founders that power needs to be checked.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's interesting to me that although conservatives, generally speaking, are very strong opponents of unions, particularly public sector unions, the unions that they tend to be the most supportive of and oftentimes extraordinarily supportive of are police unions, fire unions, and oftentimes, I mean, these unions, their primary job, of course, is to protect their members. And I think in many instances, the sort of deals that unions and cities make, these police unions make, you know, give police a level of cover from responsibility or things like qualified immunity. I wanted to talk a little bit about that because I should mention qualified immunity applies to civil suits, which oftentimes can be the only way that those who feel they've been wronged or harmed by the police can get some kind of compensation. I think, you know, there should be some reform here, but I will say that I think the Floyd Act went a little bit too far in that the Floyd Act made what I think is a reasonable change in that it stipulated that you can't claim immunity if the violation hasn't been clearly established in law at the time. And the reason why this is important is because...
Which is sort of what the case law says. Not sort of. It is what the case law says at this point.
But I mean, it and you might think, well, you know, certainly that shouldn't be too big of a burden, but it is. I'll give you an example. There was a case in Texas in 2017. A guy pours gasoline on himself and threatens to set himself on fire. The police come to the scene and they start saying, well, you know, we probably shouldn't tase the guy because it'll probably set him off. And then one of them tases him anyway. And sure enough, it sets him off and kills him. And that was covered under qualified immunity. And that's the kind of because there was nothing in case law on that, said,
because that specific factual situation had not occurred.
Exactly.
Before.
Yeah. And so I think that that's reasonable to say that, well, you know, you need to, that needs to be a little bit broader, not necessarily that specific fact pattern being covered. But where I think the Floyd Act went a little bit too far is it also eliminated immunity in instances where an officer was acting in good faith and I think reasonably, the word is reasonably believed that their conduct was lawful. And I think that seems to me to be an important standard to keep in place. But the idea that, you know, you can, in effect, set somebody on fire and say, well, you know, I there's no case law on that. I guess I'm covered. That to me is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's been sort of the issue with qualified immunity is that it often comes down to, and this isn't even necessarily I don't know if it's a legal doctrine problem or maybe it's just a judicial application problem. Because I'll you know, be frank. I mean, the courts, I don't want to say favor the police, but if you walk in as a police officer, there is an unstated, and it's not in the law, presumption that you get that you don't get if you are a defendant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's society wide, right?
Yeah.
If a guy comes up to you in uniform and says, "Hi, I'm Officer so and so. Here is, you know, this is what I believe to be true." You are more likely to accept that person's word than you are someone who's like, "Hi, I'm the guy who's just been arrested, or I'm a, you know, ex-con or whatever." And that's, you know, again, we can put all the language in the law that says we don't give presumptions one way or the other. But again, it comes back to there's sort of a human nature and a human element to this. And I think courts in a lot of cases tend to err on the side of granting immunity.
And absent, I would say absent any sort of legislative guidance on this issue, which is something that Congress could absolutely provide. Of course, state legislatures can do the same thing. And I think there needs to be much more of that, though politically that tends to be somewhat unpopular, I think, with a lot of
the downside is, I mean, what you don't want to do is subject police departments and police officers to frivolous civil suits.
Sure.
Or suits that are, I mean, you know, the classic sort of what you would think that would be in immunity is, There is, you know, there's a pursuit, dangerous criminals on the run. Cop runs the light, chasing them, and, you know, smashes into your car. Right. That's the kind of situation that qualified immunity would be designed to cover.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
That it is incidental to the law enforcement. You know, there's so long as the police officer had the good faith belief that this was a dangerous person that needed to be pursued and so forth. But I think, yeah, there needs to be bounds on qualified immunity. I think the strictures that the way the court has interpreted that, well, you know, well, look, the facts on that case, the robbery took place on a Tuesday and
exactly.
This is Thursday.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. I mean, those really fine distinctions, I think that's incorrect. But I go back to the other point though, straight out constitutional violations, 1983 violations, as they call them, Section 1983, that you can sue when your constitutional rights are violated, like beating someone who's helpless.
Yeah.
That's never been covered by qualified immunity.
Right. Right.
You know, intentional, tortious, illegal acts have always been outside of qualified immunity. Yes, that's when I say I agree with you that I think there ought to be some reform in the qualified immunity doctrine. But that it's not going to be a panacea.
Sure. No, I don't think anything will be a panacea just because of the nature of power. But I think more broadly, you know, I'll come back to this, and I've talked about this a number of times, and it tends to get some folks, I guess, on the left upset. But I feel that we have to both hold people who we give the authority to use force to a much higher standard than we currently do. But that also means then that I think we need to pay them a lot more than they get paid. You know, the median salary for a Memphis cop is around $57,000. And when you consider the stressfulness of that sort of job and what we are asking these folks to do day in and day out, that to me doesn't seem, that to me seems low. And, you know, people make decisions about careers based on financial incentives in no small part. And so if you keep that salary relatively low compared to other things people can be doing, you're going to change your applicant pool. You're going to change the sort of people you get. And so for a long time, I've said we need to pay cops a lot more and we need to hold them to much higher standards. And I think longer term, that's the sort of thing that is likely to give us better results, as well as, and I don't disagree with people who say cops shouldn't be social workers, mental health workers. I do think that there needs to be more of a differentiation in trying to get the right people out to the right scenes. That can be maybe tricky to do in practice, though some cities have had some success with it. And I think there need to be more experiments, more programs that do that as well.
Well, in this case, though, I mean, this was a special task force, right?
Scorpion unit.
Yeah, it was created to be essentially badasses.
Exactly. And that's part of the
dirty, hairy, you know, get tough on crime. That's what they recruited these guys for.
Yeah. Exactly. And those are the folks who need the most. Though I would say those are exactly the sort of units that need extra oversight built into them. The more kind of paramilitary and badass you make a unit, the more I want to see some very, very serious oversight. So those folks know that, yeah, you can be badass, but if you step over the line, you're going to get stumped on.
Yeah.
And
so this brings me to something else that and I kind of want to get your thoughts on, because there is all this, and I don't disagree with you on police salaries, although I will point out that in most cases it depends on the cities that you're in, obviously, but there is often a pretty big back end pension
for police officers. Sure, and that's going to be a factor as well.
You can retire. Like my friend did, he's retired at 50. And I think making more than, and again, it was almost ironically, right? Making more than he was making for most of his career.
Right. Because of how those pensions are structured, and that's, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, yeah. So I would prefer you know, more upfront pay and give them a 401k type thing, right? But again, that comes down to union bargaining and so forth. But in terms of, there's always this discussion about, well, geez, if we have more training, if we train these people more. And to me, it's just sort of, well, what training do you need to know that you don't beat an unarmed, helpless person to death?
See, right? I agree with you.
No, it's not like there's like there was that, with that, we had one extra page in the manual.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think it's not a question of, well, it's partly a question of training, but I would say it's more, the thing that we neglect more is screening. And when you have issues,
I'm with you on that. Yeah.
But the problem, of course, is when you have instances where people are reluctant to want to become law enforcement officers because of all these issues and so forth. And then you can only do so
and
much.
You need people to do the job, and you don't have the best candidate pool.
Yeah. You work with the applicant pool you have. And so I think I agree with you. The way that you really change the culture is by changing sort of the psychological profile makeup of the people. And that's a pretty significant effort that would require a lot of years and a lot of, but I think it's something that's long overdue.
Well, I'll say, I think we've talked about this before, and this is going years back, because this is a perennial topic. I served on our local civil service commission for my, you know, suburban Cleveland city. And the way the process works is there is a pool of applicants who take the test. And there's also sort of a additional psychological sort of tests and interviews and so forth after that. And in order for someone to be taken off of the eligible list, it's typically the department or the chief of police has to go to the Civil Service Commission and say, listen, I have concerns about this person being on the list because of X, Y, and Z. And then there's a vote. And there's a potential appeal from that vote. But I can tell you that in my experience and the department that I worked with, the police chief was extremely vigilant in just that kind of screening. Mm-hmm. And bringing to the, you know, Civil Service Commission's attention, listen, we have concerns about this guy. He passed the test, but, you know, he does have, you know, his answers to these questions were evasive. We didn't trust him here. He, you know, failed the polygraph, whatever. So those were all the types of things that were in place. Now, again, in where I live, in a suburban community that is, we border the city of Cleveland, and there's crime, but we're not a big city police department.
It's not Cleveland crime. Yeah,
exactly. So it's and I don't know the level of resources, obviously, in various cities are going to.
And not just that, I would argue
from one place to another. But
I would argue it's one thing to get certain results on a test in a room somewhere. It's another thing to actually observe how a person acts in real world situations. And so the problem with that, of course, is once you go through the trouble of initial training for everyone, and there's maybe an inclination to not want to wash people out in that probationary period because you've already put a lot of time and money in. But I would say that it's, you know, I'm not saying you need Navy SEAL level, you know, washout kind of levels, but I think certainly I would feel more comfortable if more people didn't make it through that process, because it would suggest to me that the screening process then is actually working and you're getting people out when you can, because that's about the only point. Once you get through that probationary period, typically then you have some sort of almost like a property right to your job, and it's very difficult to deprive you of that after the fact because of various, well, the agreements between the unions and the cities.
So my police chief friend, he's actually done training at like Ohio's Police Academy, and his suggestion, I think this is a good one, is to open up the policing ranks and let more younger people, college students who are interested in law enforcement, right? You know, serve what may, you know, like, for lack of a better word, be called internships, right? But actually putting them out there and seeing how to react and how they react and letting them get a taste of this. Is this, you know, what you really want? And then after they go and graduate from the academy, you know, they're going to come out better prepared to deal with the real life situations. And I'm sure, I imagine there's some places that do things like that already.
Sort of like ride-alongs on steroids sort of thing, basically.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
See certain liability or and other actually, issues yeah, with
I think
that.
I think in Ohio there's a limit or a age limit about when you could actually become a peace officer. I think that was sort of the issue. Like maybe you can't actually be sworn in as a peace officer until you're 21 or something. Mm-hmm. And we should I could get him on the show probably to talk about this. But the idea is lower that level that you know you can actually have these.
See that you know, that seems to me to be kind of
subject to supervision.
That to me seems going in the wrong direction. I would argue. I would say you don't expand the pool by just kind of changing your standards. I think that you know younger folks, other things being equal, tend to have more issues with impulse
control.
Even
more idiots. Yeah.
Exactly. You know. So I don't know that I would feel too comfortable about that exactly. But there was one other part of this I wanted to raise with you, the issue of race. Now, in this case, the officers involved were black. Everyone involved, including Tyree Nichols, were black. And the Memphis's police chief, also a black person, said that, well, because everyone's black in here, it takes race off the table as a contributing factor. But some folks argue, no, that's not actually the case, that just because these are black police officers who essentially beat to death a black young man, that doesn't mean that this isn't racially motivated. And there were plenty of outlets on the right who sort of mocked that view. But I think there's something, I don't know that I fully agree with that, but I think certainly there's enough evidence to suggest that you can be biased against the racial group and be part of that racial group. And so while it might not be as clear cut and obvious as if they were, five, KKK hood wearing white guys, right? I don't know that it's ridiculous on the face of it to say that there's a racial component here, but I wanted to get your view on that.
So I've said this, this is like politics guy flashback. Again, going back to somewhere like our early
well, sadly, yeah, we've been talking about this a lot over the years, yeah.
It's my contention that many of the issues that we put file under the category of race are not so much racially motivated as they are socially economically motivated. And I think there is more of a social economic bias that transcends race, and I think that's the guiding factor in something like this, right? I'm not saying race isn't a part of it or isn't involved at all. But what I'm saying is I think if you look at the so for example, there was the years ago and during the Obama administration, the Henry Gates case. Henry Gates was a Harvard professor and locked himself out of his house, was trying to get back in. The police show up and give him a hard time. Henry Gates is an African-American. And there was this sense, and Obama said, the police acted stupidly. And he was right. But there was a sense of, look, if Henry Gates, who is a 70-something professorial-looking sort of guy, every time I've always ever seen pictures of him, right? He's always kind of wearing a, a sport coat. Yep. And, tweed, he does not look like a street hoodlum by any stretch of the imagination. Because, he's outside of the profile age wise, he would seem to be outside of the profile socioeconomically of that sort of thing. And so I think those are, there's those sorts of issues. And again, going back to, what my police chief friend had said when we talked about some of these cases, he said it's less that the police see this person as black or white, but they see him as this is just another dirtbag.
Well, I don't get how that follows though. If you see somebody with like you said, like Professor Gates.
Well, I'm saying the Henry Gates situation would be more an indication of racism.
Okay, yeah, but I mean,
right, that the only factor you would say, hey, it's a black guy. I think that does right. indicate that there's some sort of racial animus.
Yeah, because I mean, you take a look at the Tyre Nichols thing. I mean, he seemed like he was driving like a regular car that anyone would drive. It wasn't some kind of I don't know, tricked out sort of, oh, this looks like the kind of car that a gang person would drive or something like that. He didn't look in any way suspicious.
Right.
As far as I could tell, the only thing that would distinguish him from you or me is that he was younger and he was black.
Yeah.
And so that to me suggests, well, yeah, I mean, race, you know, people who say, well, would he have been, would this have happened had he been white? I think it's a reasonable question to ask. And, you know, I think in many instances in the past, at least a reasonable answer to that is no, regardless of the race.
I think you're probably right. So that's what I'm saying. Gotcha. I'm not saying that you take race out of the equation altogether.
But I see what you're saying. I agree that a lot of these issues, there is an overlap between race and socioeconomic. Where we probably part company is, I probably see race, generally speaking, as a larger independent factor than you might, perhaps.
Correct. So, correct.
There we go.
And I would reject the idea, and you're not saying this, but someone on the far left do, that the very idea of policing is somehow birthed in racism and so forth.
Well, I'll say yes and no. You certainly can trace back the origins of certain law enforcement bodies to slavery in that era, but I don't think that means that it's inexorably bound up in that sort of thing. So no,
exactly.
I would not agree with that. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, before I move on, do you expect this to lead to any sort of legislation or executive action or anything like that at the federal level? Certainly some things are, you know, happened already in Memphis, right? They disbanded that unit and so forth. But do you expect to see anything, any action from Congress or from the Biden administration on this that would significantly change?
Yeah, actually I do. It wouldn't surprise me if there could be a bill that could come out. Because I think, when we had the dueling Tim Scott policing bill and the George Floyd, the difference came down to that scope of qualified immunity, in large part. So I think, you know, you may see a Republican House bill that could come out that would be similar to the Tim Scott bill, and we'll just see how it plays out in the Senate.
And you don't think that so you think that Republicans would be willing to offer half a loaf and Democrats would be willing to take it? That's incredibly optimistic.
I don't know if Democrats would be willing to take it.
Yeah. I don't even know that. Well, I think Republicans might be willing to offer a crust, but if they were actually willing to offer half a loaf, I would hope that Democrats would take it in lieu of nothing. But I don't even think it's going to go that far. So, but I would like to think that your more optimistic view of this is the right one, and we shall see in the weeks to come. So moving on, late last week, the New York Times published the results of a fairly extensive investigation into the Durham investigation, which was launched back in 2019, that'd be a long one, when then Attorney General William Barr appointed Durham to head an investigation into the FBI's handling of their 2016 investigation into allegations of ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. And in late 2020, Barr named Durham special counsel so that way the investigation could continue into the Biden administration. And now, after over 3 years investigating, somewhere around $6.5 million, there's been one conviction, a low-level FBI attorney who pleaded guilty to doctoring an email that was part of the justification for a FISA warrant on Carter Page, who was a Trump campaign advisor. And there were two other prosecutions against Igor Danchenko and Michael Sussman. Those resulted in acquittals. Now, a final report from Durham is expected soon, within the next month or two, I would expect. This months-long New York Times review of the investigation found that, or alleges that, contrary to Barr's claim that the investigation, in his words, cannot and will not be a tit-for-tat exercise, and standards would not be lowered just to achieve a result, that at least you can make the case is what happened, at least in part, or maybe at least that Barr inappropriately interfered in what's supposed to be an ostensibly independent investigation in order to sort of try to tip the scales. At least that's kind of how the New York Times investigation sort of comes out, I think. And it seems to me that regardless of how much actual steering of the investigation Barr did, I think it's reasonable for the public to expect that an attorney general wouldn't be getting weekly updates on the kind of day-to-day operations of a special counsel investigation, and that the attorney general wouldn't be, you know, hanging out, having dinner and drinks with the special counsel, going on trips as Barr and Durham did on multiple occasions, at least according to various sources that were interviewed by the Times. And in response to all of this, Barr spoke to the Los Angeles Times this week and said, the idea that there was a thin basis for doing it, meaning the Durham investigation, doesn't hold water. And he also said, one of the duties of the attorney general is to protect against the abuse of criminal and intelligence powers, that they're not abused to impinge on political activity. So I felt it was my duty to find out what happened there. And Barr said he violated no Department of Justice rules by meeting, eating, drinking, traveling with Durham. And he criticized the Times reporting, saying they ignored some fundamental facts as to why some of the information that Durham was seeking was very important information. So, Jay, what's your view on all this?
If you just were to pull me aside on the street and say, "Quick, New York Times or Bill Barr," you can probably guess where I'm headed on that. I don't know that. Again, my sense, and we'll have to wait for the final Durham report, is I don't see anything inappropriate, or how, if you want to say having dinner or something like that. I mean, these are people who have known each other for years and years. It is in a problem, right?
I guess I'm unclear on that.
And I guess the whole thing, if the genesis of the probe is, Durham, I want you to find out if there's anything inappropriate, abuses of power that have gone on in my agency. I think it's appropriate for him to be in contact with him throughout. So absent anything saying, you know, Barr somehow insisted on conclusions or tried to dissuade Durham from other evidence or from doing things or had him investigate people who shouldn't have been investigated. My sense is this is sort of the New York Times being the New York Times.
Well, let me push back on that.
I would add it also. The timing to me on these kind of things tends to be sort of suspect. And the headline is sort of, you know, whatever, Durham investigation a failure. It's sort of a conclusory opinion-based headline.
Well, I think you're wrong. I'll disagree with you on a number of accounts here. From my view, the narrative is this: Bill Barr essentially, you could argue, campaigned for the attorney general position in the Trump administration based on his clear and vociferously often stated view that the FBI's, that the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, the Russia investigation, shouldn't have happened, that it was problematic from the beginning. So this is his pre-existing view. So then when he gets into power, he has the ability to launch an investigation into that investigation. But he says, well, I'll do that with a special counsel. And I that makes sense to me. I agree with his statement that, hey, you know, if we're concerned, if there's any reason to believe that, in fact, law enforcement is going after people for political reasons, that's a huge problem. Absolutely. But given his statements that clearly bias him already, right, we know those statements are out there, I would think that it's totally reasonable, despite what kind of relationship he might have had in the past with Durham, is to say to Durham, listen, for the sake at least of appearances, We
the
should
perceptions,
not,
yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's, and I, Barr did not do that. And I think that's completely, so he's right in one instance that, yes, I think I supported, I've said from the beginning, I supported the Durham investigation, which it seems to me, barring some bizarre last minute thing, I mean, the grand jury was dismissed a while ago. Not much seems going to come out of this. That doesn't mean it's not worth doing. It just means it didn't. In a way, you could say, well, this is a positive thing because those who thought that the FBI was rife with corruption and this was a horrible miscarriage of justice, well, it doesn't seem to be after a lengthy, extensive, three, almost 4 year long investigation that there was much of that. And that's a good thing. Right. I would
Although
think.
There is a large body of the Durham report that is said to be still classified and. You know, and probably will be when it's still actually circulated, sure. Still be classified.
But my point
unless
is,
it turns up in somebody's garage, yeah, we might not know.
But my point is that based on what we've seen from publicly available information, indictments, convictions, court cases, that sort of thing, there just wasn't much there.
I guess you could have that again. I'll wait for the full report.
Sure.
But no, look, I take your point on the. Would have been better for perception's sake for Barr to absolutely have kept Durham at arm's length and so forth. I think it would have just in terms of helping the optics. But I don't see him doing that as a problem on the merits, right? I think it's more an optics problem just because had he done that, he would have saved the hassle of having a New York Times story.
I hate the word optics, and I hate the word optics because it's one of those
perception.
It's one of those crappy PR words, and I think it really matters in that you should not
appearance of impropriety.
Well, not How's only that? That, but if you are a strong opponent of something, and you appoint somebody to investigate it, and you have regular contact with them, I think it doesn't make sense to me to assume that, well, you're not going to have some influence over that person. Is that person completely impervious, somehow above any sort of influence? I think that's an incorrect view of how human beings work. And so it's not just optics. It's not just perception. It's saying, you know what? I think it's very important as a matter of justice that I not attempt to put my thumb on the scale here, and to avoid even the possibility of that, I'm going to stay away from this investigation, except for in any case it's absolutely necessary. And Bill Barr didn't do that, and so I'd say he failed in his role here.
So I differentiate the role of Bill Barr because between the guy, the chief prosecutor who appoints the special prosecutor, as it were, and that of a judge, because look, he's not a judge. He's still ostensibly in charge of the prosecution. I
would agree if it were a DOJ investigation, but I disagree because he appointed a special counsel precisely because it was an internal thing. And there was a very real reason to think that an agency investigating itself would be biased. Now, normally you think, well, it's going to be biased for itself.
Biased the other way.
But
right.
I guess
that was my point.
But this is different because in this case, you have the person in charge of the agency of DOJ, the attorney general, being on record as being biased in the other direction.
Yeah. But perhaps that bias is justified.
But it wouldn't matter if it's justified or not. I mean, if you're trying to do a fair investigation, you don't start with that bias. That's why you bring in a special counsel. And so I agree with what Barr did in appointing Durham, but then after that, he dropped the ball.
All right.
So
let me just throw this out there, because this is the question that sort of woke me up in the middle of the night last night. As I was thinking
okay.
about what I was going to say on this. And this may come across as inflammatory, but I don't mean it that way. And that is, did Kevin Kleinsmith act alone? And Kevin Kleinsmith being the FBI lawyer who altered an email from the CIA that said Carter Page is one of our assets, is a good guy, to read he is not one of our assets, which was the basis for a warrant. And by saying did he act alone, I'm not necessarily suggesting conspiracy of all these people, but did it, it, it see what was his motive, right? If not the idea of, hey, these guys really want to get the warrant. They really want to get Page. They really want to get Trump. I'm going to do my part. It would seem to be an unusual thing just for someone off the top of their head, say, God, I hate Trump. I'm going to alter the CIA email so we can spy on his low-level foreign policy advisor. And that's what troubles me, right?
I think you're making too much of
it. He did that for a reason. Yeah. He didn't do it by accident.
Well, of course he didn't do it by accident. But I think saying that it's some sort of political thing, I mean, when you have people involved at various levels in these investigations, I think there is certainly going to be a bias for, well, we want this investigation to come up with something. And so we are going to look for reasons, especially if it's a big investigation where a lot of people's careers can be made. And hey, if you were part of the team on this one and helped us out, well, you can kind of come along for the ride. And that's regardless of whether it's John Gotti, Donald Trump, you name it, right?
Exactly.
It's a high profile investigation. And so, of course, he didn't just one day just decide, oh, I'm just going to change this from one thing to another because, I don't know, I'm feeling frivolous today. Of course, there were reasons. Yeah. People do these things for reasons. And of course, there need to be investigations of this. I absolutely believe that we need to have much better oversight in general of law enforcement. When that oversight itself becomes politicized, then that's because then you have investigations of investigations of investigations. And I think this is where we're at this third level, right? And that's when it becomes sort of this never-ending cycle of politicized investigations.
But isn't this sort of exactly what we were talking about just a minute ago, right? Of we want to see checks on the police power, whether it's police on the streets or whether it's the FBI, because power corrupts absolutely.
And so
to me, this is sort of exactly the same sort of situation. And the other piece that strikes me is also what you had mentioned about the Memphis officers wearing the body cams and so forth. And they still did it because they still thought they could get away with it. And that's my sense of Klein Smith as well.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
A large part he did. He got a very light sentence and he's practicing law again.
And so there's a balance here. And just like with the Memphis, just like with law enforcement, there's a balance. And we were talking about this qualified immunity. You want to make sure that people who have a great deal of power to potentially ruin people's lives or take their lives, that they are held accountable and that they realize that they will be held accountable. But you don't want to do so much to put a straitjacket on them that they are afraid to do their job, especially when it comes to, say, prosecuting or investigating a powerful person who can bring resources to bear against them. And that can be a challenging balance.
Yeah.
And I think you'd agree
with
that.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
All right. All right, well, let's move on to foreign policy. Late this week, the United States and the Philippines announced an agreement that would give U.S. forces access to 4 additional military sites in that country, as well as strengthening ties between the country, which is a relationship that can be especially valuable, I think, in the case of a potential conflict between U.S. and China over Taiwan, which is seeming more and more likely in recent years. And the last U.S. troops that left the Philippines, this was in the 1990s, and actually since then, the country changed its constitution and they prohibit permanent basing of foreign troops in the country, but temporary exercises and things like that are okay. And this is in the larger context of Manila and Beijing being at odds really for a number of years now, over waters in the South China Sea that both countries claim as their own. And a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry responded to this agreement saying, out of self-interest, the United States continues to strengthen its military development or deployment in the region with a zero-sum mentality, which is exacerbating tension in the region and endangering regional peace and stability. Countries in the region should remain vigilant against this and avoid being coerced and used by the United States. You know, relations between the U.S. and the Philippines, which, by the way, was an American colony from 1898 to 1946, they deteriorated pretty significantly under the Duterte presidency, which lasted for 6 years, ended just last year. And Duterte was replaced by Ferdinand Marcos Jr. That's a familiar name to older folks because, yeah, he's the son of the former dictator and close U.S. ally Ferdinand Marcos. Now, Marcos Jr. said he cannot see the Philippines in the future without having the United States as a partner, which is a big change from Duterte, who said of the U.S., I've seen America and it's lousy. So a big change in viewpoint there. I should finally point out that in addition to its closeness to China, the Philippines is strategically valuable because of the kind of almost jungle-like sort of ocean undergrowth in much of that area, which makes it an ideal place for masking submarine movements. So, Jay, what do you think about the U.S. increasing its military presence, its military ties with the Philippines?
I'm all for it.
All for it. And you're not.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I think not to acknowledge that China is a strategic threat is the height of folly, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And China has been seeking to expand its physical footprint in the South China Sea. It has become increasingly belligerent to other allies. In the region. And I think it makes all the sense in the world to show our commitment not only to the people of the Philippines, but to our other allies in the region that sphere of influence would be contested.
Yep. I am 100% with you on this. I don't think I have anything to add on that particular issue. I sort of thought this was one where we would be in lockstep, though I certainly understand, given the fraught history between the United States and Philippines, where some people in that country would be uncomfortable with U.S. with an increased U.S. presence. I mean, it's not like some anti-U.S. views came out of nowhere, but I still would like to believe that we are far superior to the Chinese alternative, I guess.
Yes.
So
yes.
There you go. And, you know, kind of semi-related to this, the news that everyone's talking about, right, is that big Chinese weather balloon, if you believe them, right, that violated U.S. airspace. And it's, you know, seen in multiple U.S. states, but most famously Montana or Beijing says, well, mainly weather research, blown off course. The Pentagon said, I don't think so. A statement from China on it, read in part, the Chinese side regrets the unintended entry of the airship into U.S. airspace due to force majeure, which basically means, hey, it wasn't our fault. And, you know, there were a number of people on the right who said, why haven't we shot it down? Donald Trump said that in all caps. Of course he did. Nikki Haley, you know, that's how you do it. And defense officials rejected that because they felt that even in a sparsely populated area, there was a danger that debris could cause damage to people and or property and that it wasn't posing any significant threat. Though it did result in Secretary of State Anthony Blinken postponing his planned trip to China, which was scheduled to take place on February 5th. And sixth. I should also point out that China has an extensive network of surveillance satellites. It's second only to the United States. And while it seems unlikely that this is some kind of major, you know, major spying sort of thing, though it could potentially provide China with information on signals, intelligence, and other things like that. And also, there have been similar incidents with Chinese balloons over Hawaii and Guam in recent years. So, Jay, what do you make of the big Chinese balloon over Montana or wherever it is right now?
Wouldn't you like to ride in my beautiful
balloon? I needed to work that in here somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I think it's important.
But I'm a little curious whether this is not an intentional Chinese attempt to scuttle the Blinken visit. I don't know in terms of shooting it down. Hell yeah, that'd be a lot of fun, right? I'm not sure whether there's any information we can glean by not shooting it down, right? By just doing something else or capturing it or how we go about it, or whether it's our strategic position that we're just going to be like, look, we're so cool, we're just going to ignore this. because it's not a threat. I'm not necessarily crazy about the ignoring it forever, because I think that sends a message to the Chinese and allows sort of a Chinese propaganda machine of look, the Americans can't even, you know, take out our balloon kind of thing. So I'd be honest, but I think we do have to deal with it eventually. I think canceling the Blinken visit is the right thing to do, even if it may be the thing the Chinese wanted us to do. This aggression cannot stand. I think you can't just let cede our airspace to the Chinese. So I'm hopeful that we either knock it down, shoot it down, capture it, deflate it, however you go about doing that, so that we can have one, proof that it was a Chinese spy balloon, and two, show that we will defend our airspace.
Sure. I mean, there are a couple levels to sort of approach this on, and one level, that kind of straight ahead level you're suggesting, is this aggression cannot stand, we shoot it down, we capture it, what have you. And obviously that's a lot more complex. This is not just like some version of a, you know, large version of a Mylar balloon that you might get, you know, for a party or something like this. So there's, you know, a little bit involved certainly in capturing it or taking it down than maybe what most people would think. But you know, another way, and I tend to agree with you that it probably is something along the lines of a Chinese test just to see how we will react. But on one level, you can just say, well, we will not let this aggression stand. The other level, you can say, well, it is our handling of it can be sort of a bargaining chip we can use, saying, well, we will not let this stand in exchange for X behind the scenes. And of course, there's a lot that we don't know about what's going on behind the scenes in various negotiations, including things about, well, and this is something we'll get to on the midweek show, about Chinese solar panels. And there are all kinds of underlying issues about, obviously, Russia, Ukraine, and intellectual property and trade and all kinds of things. And this fits into that larger scope of issues. But yeah, as a general rule, I say we can't just say, well, you know, no big deal, no harm, no foul, we're going to accept this at your word. But I also think that just, you know, having fighter jets shoot it down before we kind of consider what's going on, that's not necessarily the smartest way to handle things.
But it would be cool.
I do
think there's something to the idea of just having this massive blow the thing out of the sky with as much, you know, firepower as you can, just as a demonstration at some point. But maybe we're not at that point yet.
But and, you know, like, I think there's one level to say that it shows, in a sense, that kind of indifference can show.
Right, exactly. We're too cool to worry about it.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. But yeah, it is.
No, I hear that. I hear that too. But also I don't want to get the sense, I don't want the Taiwanese to be thinking, geez, sure, they're not even going to take out the balloon over their own country.
Yeah, I'm like, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I think my guess is it's just going to be one of those things that just sort of comes and goes, floats away, as it were. But certainly, I think we can't just let hostile or strategic adversaries think that we just sort of will let slights go. But if more balloons appear, then I think that's another story. But for now, anyway.
Well, there's one over Central America now.
One over Central. So the balloons just kind of keep on coming, basically. So there we go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before we go, Jay, do you have any recommendations this week?
Oh, gosh. Can you go first?
Can I go first? Well, you know, I'll go first. Sure. Lately, I've been watching a really fun new show. I guess we're talking about Chinese and spies and all that, called The Recruit. It's on Netflix. It's about a young 20-something attorney for the CIA General Counsel's Office who gets involved in all sorts of interesting, crazy antics that involve national security and so forth. There's some torture scenes and other stuff like that. It's weird. It's dramatic, but it's also sort of funny and a lot of fun. And I'm enjoying watching it. So that's going to be my recommendation for this week, The Recruit.
Okay. So gosh, I So can I, how about this as a recommendation? I just want to say, this is what I did last weekend, Mike. I went ice climbing.
Ooh.
Wow. For the first time last Sunday in a place called Fenton, Michigan. They have this set up, this like, so you practice ice climbing. It's like a sort of tower made of ice. And yeah, so I did the whole thing with like you got like your pickaxe kind of thing and crampons, and you're roped in like with the belay kind of thing of somebody hanging on. But it was crazy. It was super fun. And like my forearms, I couldn't lift couldn't lift a pencil like the next day, because it's this crazy thing of like muscles you're not used to using. No, that was a ton of fun. So if you have the opportunity to go ice climbing, I recommend it. That's a little weird than as opposed to just watch this show or read this book, but you know.
Yeah, I've done indoor bouldering, and that I know a lot of people have done that. It's probably a little more accessible. I feel like almost that you have now kind of done the uber hipster level of that, because this is much more exclusive, right? Oh, sure, you've bouldered, but have you done ice climbing? So, Jay,
well, we went to like a bouldering gym to do like the practicing for the ice.
Oh, climbing. I see. So that is even more exclusive.
So yeah, we did go to like a rock climbing gym to do like the practice stuff.
Yeah, that's Jay. Jay is an elite. So bouldering, it's already an elite thing, but that wasn't enough for Jay, who has to set himself up. He has to go to Michigan to do ice climb, because you know it's winter and his yacht's in the dry dock.
That's what I do, guess,
with all the other Russian oligarchs and other folks, and so malefactors of great wealth, and so you need to do something in your off time. I get it. So there you ice climbing. That does sound like a lot of fun. So all right, well, before we do go, one other thing, we want to thank Wade, our newest supporter. We really do appreciate it. And as a supporter, of course, you get a bunch of stuff like full access to our complete midweek show, which Jay and I will be recording in just a minute. We're going to be talking about the removal of Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee, Nikki Haley's presidential bid, China, a waiver on solar tariff, solar panels that some people are fighting now, and a continuation of our series on American greatness. That should be interesting. I'm looking forward to it. So if you want to get all that, you can become a supporter. Just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you'd like to support us on Venmo or at politicsguys, you can also support us through PayPal. All of our support links, as always, are in our show notes, as well as on politicsguys.com/support. If you'd like to become a supporter, but you can't afford to become a supporter right now, but you want all those perks, that's not a problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make sure you get the midweek show in its entirety every single week. And whether you're a supporter or not, it really does help if you can spread the word by talking about the show on social media, email, carrier pigeon, you name it, whatever works for you. We certainly appreciate it. And that includes ratings and reviews on whatever app you happen to be listening to the Politics Guys on. And if you want to get in touch with us, there's email, mail@politicsguys.com. There's our fantastic Discord channel for supporters, which is always a lot of fun, as well as Facebook and Twitter. And you will find links in the show notes. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.